Hi there. My name is Jennifer Stallo. I'm a transplant infectious disease provider from Duke University Medical Center. Today, we're going to be talking about immune modulatory agents and what can be tested for the boards. This is my disclosure slide. I have no real relevant disclosures apart from royalties received from UpToDate on chapter dealing with myocarditis. And so why are we talking about immune modulatory agents today? Well, I don't think I need to remind you all of why they're important. This is a rapidly expanding group of therapeutics with, you know, an equally rapidly expanding field of applications for these, oftentimes in combination therapy. And each of these agents has a unique mechanism of action wherein there's an immune deficit that is delivered through the therapy that merits consideration of distinct infection risks. There are some really high yield board concepts that I want to talk about when we're thinking about these therapies. And I want to go over these today. We will talk about the individual agents and some examples of infections and different concepts around these drugs. But I want you to really remember to focus on these things, because I do think these are the things that the boards will want you to, the concepts they will want you to understand. And that is, one, just recognizing the immune deficit, what classic infections are associated with these therapies, know the relevant screening and prophylaxis that you should consider in patients receiving these therapies, what vaccines they need, and that includes what type of vaccines, the timing of the vaccines, and when there are contraindications to specific vaccines. Importantly, I think throughout these lectures, you'll hear to recognize mimics. So in this situation, it's the immune modulatory toxicities versus mimics of the underlying disease versus a true infection. And I try to point out, and I kept in mind in thinking about areas to focus on, things that are FDA black box warnings in terms of infections with these therapies, but it's important to be cognizant of that. And so what are the agents we're going to discuss today? The key agents we're going to discuss are listed here. They include the lymphoid cell targeted monoclonal antibodies, and we'll focus on anti-CD20 and 52 therapies, tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibitors, Janase kinase inhibitors, interleukin-6 and interleukin-17 inhibitors, appreciating there are multiple others in this group of therapeutics, complement inhibitors, the sphingosine-1-phosphate receptor modulators, immune checkpoint inhibitors, integrin inhibitors, although we'll focus specifically on natalizumab, and then Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I want to make note that we are not going to be talking in this lecture about CAR T-cell specific or bispecific T-cell engager therapeutics. Those will be discussed in a lecture that I'm giving live at the boards on infections and neutropenic cancer patients. I'll also comment that this list of agents obviously is not exhaustive. There are a multitude of immune modulatory therapies that are being used in clinical practice, not all of which do we have time to discuss today, but really tried to focus on some of the high yield ones for the boards. So before we start jumping into the individual therapeutics, let's think about what is important for us in terms of general principles as the ID test taker and as the ID provider seeing your patients in clinic. It's important to think about screening tests, most notably viral screening, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV. In our cancer patients and in multiple patient populations, these are required screening tests that we, you know, consider it when these patients present to clinic to be initiated on these immune modulatory therapies. There are multiple therapeutics that also require screening for latent tuberculosis as well as active tuberculosis. And then depending on the patient's geographic distribution, you may be considering, for example, a patient from the Pacific Southwest, certain considerations around endemic fungi such as coccidioidomycosis, as well as other endemic risks for strongyloides. And then with vaccinations, always ensuring the patients are up to date with their relevant age and underlying disease relevant vaccinations. Thinking smartly about the timing of these vaccines, we try to get these patients vaccinated before they get started on immune modulatory therapy, but it differs with a live versus inactivated vaccine. Inactivated vaccines, typically we try to get those in within 2 weeks of starting therapy, whereas live attenuated, we usually want to have it completed within 4 weeks of starting therapies because of that theoretical risk that you could in fact get infection from a live attenuated vaccine if given in too close of proximity to an immune modulatory therapy start. And then again, just remembering these contraindications when patients are on significantly immunosuppressive or immune modulatory therapies, wherein you would really want to avoid live vaccines. Now, we're not going to go into each of the individual vaccines. Those are covered in other lectures. But these key concepts and considerations in this particular group of patients is really important as you're managing them and as you're sitting down to take your boards. Another key point to remember, and I cannot overemphasize this, and I'm not going to say this with every drug, but I want you to be thinking this with every drug, is that infection risks depend on multiple factors. The patient's age, where they live, what their underlying disease is, what other comorbidities like diabetes, asthma, COPD, what other preceding and concomitant immune modulatory / immune suppressive therapies they're receiving. That's a big one. And then how long have they been on these therapies? All these things go into the net state of immune suppression of your host, and you need to be thinking about those. Let's just jump in with some questions, and we'll try to navigate through the majority of these via questions and really focusing on the things that I think are really high yield for you to understand for the boards. So question one is a 68-year-old man. He's originally from Taiwan. He has underlying follicular lymphoma, and the team plans to initiate single-agent rituximab therapy. In this patient, which of the baseline serologies would be most important when assessing his infectious risks and the relevant need for prophylaxis with rituximab therapy? Is it cytomegalovirus, toxoplasmosis, serologic testing for hepatitis A, hepatitis B, or hepatitis C? Now, I'll give you a moment to think about that, but then we're going to jump into the answers and kind of explain why this is. So the answer to this is actually hepatitis B. And this question is begetting that you understand that rituximab is really the classic, most commonly utilized anti-CD20 therapy. It's a monoclonal antibody that targets B cells. There are others. I think rituximab is the most, you know, common and is the classic agent that likely would be the most testable. It has broad uses or clinical applications from oncology to autoimmune inflammatory disorders, both malignant and non-malignant hematologic disorders, neurologic disorders, and we even use it in transplant medicine for things like antibody-mediated rejection. What we really want to focus on with these therapies is the infection risk. And why are these therapies associated with infection? It stems from, the rationale is multifold. It's from prolonged B-cell depletion. These patients often develop hypogammaglobulinemia on therapy, and they can have early but also late onset neutropenia, that the latter occurring weeks to months post-exposure. And there's some important things that are really key about Rituxan and other anti-CD20 therapies that I think are very testable on the boards and important for you to understand. The first is that they can cause an appreciable impairment in vaccine response. So getting patients vaccinated before they start these therapies is imperative. We usually wait at least 6 to 12 months after the last dose of these therapeutics to revaccinate patients because we know that their response to vaccines is so profoundly impaired. And obviously, we avoid live vaccinations during that period. The question stem that I just presented to you really focuses on one of the bigger and I think very testable complications of anti-CD20 therapies, and that's Hep B reactivation. At its highest risk in patients that are either Hep B surface antigen or Hep B core antibody positive, but Hep B surface antigen negative. And it really has to do with the B cell depletion disrupts the immune surveillance of hepatitis B. And so very important that these patients get baseline Hep B testing, and I've detailed here what that entails. In these high-risk patients, we do recommend viral prophylaxis with entecavir or tenofovir, the newer generation therapeutics, alongside monitoring, looking for Hep B, DNA, PCR, changes in hepatic panel, or evidence of liver dysfunction that might indicate hepatitis B reactivation. And typically, we continue this prophylaxis for at least 12 months post-cessation of therapy, realizing that that risk for Hep B reactivation can go on far longer than that. And then there are other viruses that we think about associated with this therapy, including herpes, other herpes viruses, and then uncommon but can occur with JC virus. We can't uncommonly see JC virus in PML. And then although we don't specifically prophylax for pneumocystis in patients on single-agent rituximab therapy, there is a risk for that infection, particularly in patients that are receiving other concomitant therapies. The next slide I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but I think it's important that you know about this resource. This is the most recent updated AGA clinical practice guideline on prevention and treatment of hepatitis B. And it very clearly delineates these low, moderate, and high-risk groups of patients that are either Hep B surface antigen positive or isolated Hep B core antibody positive, wherein there's a risk for reactivation. And you can see the highest risk group right here that I've indicated are these B-cell depleting agents in both categories. And so again, something very, very testable on the board. So question two, this is a 63-year-old man. He has T-cell pro-lymphocytic leukemia. He's on single agent alemtuzumab. He's been receiving acyclovir prophylaxis alongside preemptive therapy for CMV. Serial plasma CMV PCR testing has been negative. He's now presenting with several weeks of slowly progressing shortness of breath, new low-grade non-neutropenic fevers, and a chest x-ray that you see above here, followed by a cross-sectional image of his chest shown below that. And the question to you is, this presentation is likely due to the lack of which of the following recommended prophylactic therapies? Okay, so I want you to think about that. Letermovir, valganciclovir, entecavir, levofloxacin, or sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim. So we've switched gears from B-cell depleting agents like rituximab, and we're talking about alemtuzumab therapy. And what I'm looking for here, the answer to this was sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim. So let's talk about why that is. So alemtuzumab is another of the lymphoid-targeted monoclonal antibodies. It targets the anti-CD52 antibody that's present on both B and T cells, as well as macrophage and NK cells, and causes profound B and T cell depletion. Again, has very broad applications in hematology, oncology, transplant medicine, and for inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. And the infection risks are multifold. The question stem that I just presented to you here is really getting into the risk of fungal infections, but also touching on other risks. So big risks that we see with this agent include viral infections, such as VZV, HSV, which is why these patients are typically on antiviral prophylaxis, CMV, which is why in the question stem, you notice that that patient was being preemptively monitored for CMV because we know that risk is there, mycobacterial and fungal infections. And in this question stem that I just presented to you, this was a patient presenting with pneumocystis pneumonia who was not on prophylactic sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim. And we can also see bacterial infections, including intracellular pathogens like listeria, after utilization of this therapy. For infection prevention, again, the question stem that I presented to you really hones in on what I think is very board testable, is that these patients receiving alemtuzumab should be on viral, so targeted therapy for HSV and VZV with acyclovir, valacyclovir, famciclovir, as well as PJP prophylaxis. And that prophylaxis should continue a minimum of 2 months post-therapy and until their CD4 count's greater than 200, whichever is longer. They also should be preemptively monitored for CMV, again, a minimum of 2 months post-alemtuzumab. And recognizing that, as with other patient populations receiving other immune modulatory therapy, they will have an impaired vaccine response, and you should not be giving these patients live vaccines while they're receiving these therapy and for a period of time post-receipt of these therapies. So we're going to leave anti-CD52. We're going to do this at a clip, and we're going to go on to our next group of therapies. And so we'll start it with a question. This is a 35-year-old woman. She has refractory Crohn's. She's scheduled to begin infliximab. She's immigrated from India to the U.S. at age 14, but has had no prior documented either TB screening or infection. She's currently well. You see her in clinic. She has no fevers. She has no cough or other constitutional symptoms, but an interferon gamma release assay is done and returns positive. And the question to you is, what is the most appropriate next best step before you begin infliximab therapy? Is it cancel planned infliximab therapy and treat her for active TB? Delay infliximab, get a chest x-ray and sputum cultures, and if the imaging is normal, go ahead and start infliximab. No additional evaluation required and begin the infliximab now. Delay infliximab, obtain chest x-ray imaging if normal, start latent TB therapy, and then begin infliximab. And then finally, should you delay infliximab, obtain chest x-ray imaging, and if normal, complete a full course of latent TB therapy before starting infliximab. So a lot of confusing choices there, and I want you to think about this for a moment, and then we will kind of cut to the next slide, and I'll explain to you what the correct answer is and why. So the correct answer in this situation is that you have a patient that is IGRP positive. You would delay the start of therapy. You would evaluate her. She's clinically asymptomatic. You get a chest x-ray. If the chest x-ray is normal, then you would start her on latent TB therapy, make sure she's tolerating therapy, and then begin infliximab. This is focusing on a new class of, and a different class of therapeutics. These are TNF-alpha inhibitors. The probably most testable and most commonly applied agent is infliximab, and I've listed some others here. All of these are monoclonal antibodies with the exception of etanercept, which is a soluble receptor fusion protein and in the literature is associated with overall less infection risk than the other monoclonal antibodies. Maybe a testable point, but I think more importantly to understand the highest infection risks associated with all of these therapies. These are used broadly for autoimmune and inflammatory conditions, much like many of the other therapies we've discussed today. And why it's important to know about these drugs is that TNF-alpha is important for particularly not maintenance as well as formation of granulomas. And hence, this question around TB becomes really imperative. It's also important in other components of the immune, the adaptive and innate immune system, the development of phagosomes, the activation and differentiation of macrophages, and also response against viral pathogens. And so what are the infection risks that we see with a TNF-alpha inhibitors? Well, bacterial infections, including intracellular pathogens. So there's many notable that are mentioned here I've listed to be thinking about. One potential board trick question, although an uncommon infection, but Whipple's disease is caused by the gram-positive actinobacteria Trypermia whipplei. And it can cause a seronegative arthropathy that can be very difficult to diagnose given the rarity of this infection. And if is diagnosed as a seronegative arthropathy and given a TNF-alpha inhibitor, you have the potential then that you would actually exacerbate an undiagnosed subclinical case of Whipple's disease. So kind of an interesting consideration. The big, and I think most testable issue is that of mycobacterial infections because of this, you know, a keen or just a very significant impact on the immune deficit that we see with these therapies. TB screening is imperative in all patients. That means a history, a clinical exam, imaging, and getting some sort of TB screening test, whether that be an IGRA or a TST. Generally speaking, in the United States, an IGRA is preferred, but both are considered options for screening. If a patient has a positive test or a screening positive, the onus is then on the provider to rule out active tuberculosis. And if active tuberculosis has then been ruled out, to initiate latent TB therapy. And in the question stem that I presented to you, it really was a little bit about the timing of that. And so starting latent TB therapy, you want to get that started before the patient start the infliximab, but you don't have to complete or whatever TNF-alpha inhibitor, but you don't have to complete the latent TB therapy before the patients start their TNF-alpha inhibitor. So most guidelines recommend 1 to 3 weeks, basically making sure that the patient's tolerating the therapy, and then you would start the TNF-alpha inhibitor. So a very testable question for the boards. These agents are also associated with reactivation of hepatitis B and other viral hepatitis. I think another very testable question on the board would be about endemic fungi, such as histoplasmosis, again, related to granuloma formation and maintenance, other opportunistic fungal infections, parasitic infections, and again, wanting to get your vaccinations updated. I think that's a pretty common theme throughout. And then remember some mimics with TNF-alpha inhibitors. They have multiple side effects. They can cause heart failure, increase risks of demyelinating diseases, as well as malignancy such as lymphoma. And so just keeping those in mind as non-infectious mimics. All right, so we're going to change gears again to the next line of therapy. So it's quick, a clipping pace here that we want to get through some of these important drugs. So what is the most effective first-line prevention strategy for the most common viral infection in patients who are initiating tofacitinib therapy for rheumatoid arthritis? Is it preemptive monitoring with weekly CMV plasma PCRs, acyclovir prophylaxis, valganciclovir prophylaxis, shingles vaccination with recombinant zoster vaccine, or regularly scheduled intravenous immunoglobulin? So I'm going to give you a second to think about that. And the next slide will go into the answer and again, discuss why. So the answer is shingles vaccination. And this question is asking you to really first identify what tofacitinib is, and that is a Janus kinase inhibitor. There are multiple of these. There are some, I'm kind of breaking these up in this slide into two groups. There's the autoimmune inflammatory disease JAK inhibitors like tofacitinib that are used for many different inflammatory and autoimmune processes that I've listed here. But there are also some that are applied in hematology oncology, probably most notably that you recognize as ruxolitinib. And I will say that patients on ruxolitinib are oftentimes far more treatment advanced, have underlying hematologic disorders. Oftentimes it's being applied for chronic graft-versus-host disease amongst other immune modulatory therapies. So these are very different patient populations wherein these drugs can be applied. And so your considerations of infections differ just based on that alone. How this works is through inhibition of these JAK-STAT pathways and results in reduced cytokine production, like the important interleukins and interferons, and their production can get reduced. It reduces immune cell development, and those that impact that cause JAK2 inhibition, such as baricitinib and ruxolitinib, can also impact some of the hematogenous progenitor cells and can result in cytopenias. And this can have an impact, obviously, on both our innate and our adaptive immunity. And so what sorts of infections does this render us susceptible to? Well, the black box warning kind of covers the gamut, but I think the most common and probably most testable for the boards would be herpes zoster reactivation. And again, it really suppresses that type 1, type 2 interferon signaling that impairs our antiviral T cell response and puts patients at risk for these infections. But you can see a host of other infections, many of which I've listed here, fungal infections, mycobacterial infections. Many of those same principles hold true. But I think of the most common, it would be herpes zoster that we need to think about. So we're going to talk a little bit about interleukin 6 inhibitors. We're going to skip a question on this one. I'm going to give you guys a break and let us take a breather. The agents that you probably most notably know about, particularly in the post-COVID era, is tocilizumab. And this is a monoclonal antibody that targets the IL-6 receptor. There are also ones that target IL-6 itself. And tocilizumab has multiple applications. We probably know it best for COVID. We also use it for a cytokine release syndrome, which we talk about in many other lectures, including our lecture on hematopoietic stem cell transplant in neutropenic cancer patients. But it's a systemic inflammatory response, you know, that's basically caused by rapid activation of immune cells and releases of large amounts of cytokines. But it has multiple other uses, both off-label and on-label. And the mechanism and immune deficit, the reason that we worry and also why we use these drugs, so we probably best know of why we use them, is for its pro-inflammatory effects, right? By blocking IL-6, we prevent these kind of these pro-inflammatory cytokines, CRP, ferritin, all of these markers of inflammation go down. But it is a pleiotropic cytokine, and it's important to understand that because it also has anti-inflammatory and regenerative properties that are important for pathogen clearance. So there are some protective mechanisms that by inhibiting, we lose. And unfortunately, these monoclonal antibodies don't discriminate between these two pathways. And so it has an impact on multiple different innate and adaptive cell lines. And the figure that I show to the right really here just not something you need to memorize for the board, but I think a really beautiful illustration and a very nice review in Lancet that kind of talks through the pleiotropic effects of this cytokine. And so what are the infectious risks? The two that have black box warnings for infections are toci and sarilumab, with a multifold of the serious infections that you can see. And I've listed those here. I'm not going to go through those in any great detail. It's very similar to some of the other agents, but I think some important considerations and things that could get tested on the boards are the fact that when you receive these agents, you may come in with infection, but many of the signs and symptoms and even the inflammatory markers, your CRP, et cetera, may be blunted or masked because of the mechanism of the drug. And that, you know, patients can even present with disseminated infection and may not have that really fulminant presentation. And so don't get tricked. IL-6 inhibitors can also be associated with an increased risk of GI perforation. So particularly in a patient that perhaps had a history of recurrent diverticulitis or that was receiving concurrent steroids. So just thinking about infection versus side effects from the medications, it might be a mimic to consider in some sort of a board question. So we're going to leave IL-6 inhibitors. We're going to go back to some questions. You guys, I gave you a break. Let's get going on some more questions. So this is a 55-year-old woman She is started on a new therapy for psoriasis 3 months ago. She comes to see you in clinic and she has recurrent oral pain and tenderness alongside these white plaques that you see on her tongue and on her palate. Which of the following was the most likely agent she was started on? Was it astretin, cyclosporin, infliximab, etanercept, or bimekizumab? And the answer to this is bimekizumab. Looking at the other options we have here, these are all, so they're kind of tricking you here because they're all options that you could use to treat psoriasis. This the first is a oral retinoid. Cyclosporin is a calcium urine inhibitor that we don't touch on in this lecture, but is touched on in some of the transplant lectures that are live at the course. Infliximab and etanercept, we've already talked about these two TNF-alpha inhibitor therapies. But now we're talking about a new therapy, bimekizumab, and these are IL-17 inhibitors, and I think important because you might get asked about this on the boards. And so these are agents that, as I mentioned, that target IL-17. There are multiple therapies. This question stem included bimekizumab. It's, again, used for many autoimmune and inflammatory diseases, including psoriasis, as we discussed in the question stem. And basically, the mechanism this and how there it results in this immune defect is that it reduces neutrophil recruitment as well as antimicrobial peptide production at the mucosal and skin surfaces. It also has an impact on the gut epithelial barrier, and inhibition of that can reduce that protection. But I think, you know, when we're thinking about infection risks on the board, the mucocutaneous candidiasis, a patient coming in with a new psoriatic therapeutic started with mucocutaneous candidiasis, you want to think about IL-17 inhibition. And, you know, it can be oral, it can be vaginal. It's typically mild to moderate and tends to respond to normal treatments, but it is a common infectious complication of these therapies. They can also be associated with other infectious risks, but less so than many of the other therapies. And then another potential mimic is for inflammatory bowel disease, and there's a recommendation that these not be used in patients that have active IBD because, again, of this impact on the gut protective aspects of IL-17, that it can result in either new onset or exacerbation of IBD. Question number 6. 35-year-old female, she comes with fevers, headaches, confusion, and a diffuse petechial rash. 4 months ago, she was diagnosed with paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria after evaluation for abdominal pain, dark urine, hemolytic anemia, and portal vein thrombosis. At that time, she was started on eculizumab with improvement in these symptoms. She's now coming in and on exam. She's febrile to 39.4 degrees Celsius. She's hypotensive with a blood pressure of 86 over 52. She's got neck stiffness, and her blood cultures from the lab are growing gram-negative diplococci. I think we all know what infection we're dealing with here, but that's not the question. The question is the patient's infection is most likely due to impaired what? So again, we're asking about mechanism and immune deficit associated with therapy. Is it because of impaired neutrophilic burst, terminal complement-mediated bacterial lysis, interleukin-6 activity, interleukin-17 activity, or C3b-mediated opsonization? And the answer is terminal complement mediated bacterial lysis. And let's talk about that. Let's dive into that a little bit more. So again, they're wanting you to pick up in the question stem that this is talking about a complement inhibitor. Eculizumab is one of the most commonly utilized complement inhibitors. It is a monoclonal antibody. There are also peptide and macrocyclic as well as small molecular inhibitor therapies. There's a growing number of complement inhibitors with differing mechanisms of action and a broad application of therapy. We see it used in PNH. We see it in multiple renal disorders and neuromyelitis optica. There's quite a few applications. And again, these applications are growing. And what are the risks? Well, I think, you know, most of the board questions, I suspect, about complement inhibitors are really going to focus on the infection risks. And it has to do with the mechanism of action of these therapeutics. And so I think it is worth a brief review of the complement pathway because, you know, it can be tricky. And I hope this is, you know, big picture for you to think about in terms of how these drugs act, where they act, and what the implications of their actions are. So The main triggers by bacterial pathogens, and in this situation, we're talking about encapsulated bacteria, Neisseria, Haemophilus, Pneumococcus, can be through one of these three pathways. And then basically the complement cascade begins, and there is a proximal and terminal component of that. We typically think about, you know, when we're thinking about complement inhibitors in the past, we've really thought most about the terminal complement cascade, which are mainly the C5 inhibitors. But as you can see, there are a growing number of therapeutics in this terminal complement cascade kind of region, in this region of this mechanism, in terms of the mechanism of action. The target in the end of these terminal complement inhibitors is to inhibit the membrane attack complex, which is to inhibit a membrane attack complex, MAC, which is crucial for protection against encapsulated bacteria, most notably against Neisseria. And patients that have this pathway inhibited are at very increased risk, a very high or increased risk of disseminated Neisseria infections, most notably Neisseria meningitis, as in this question stem. But other types of encapsulated organisms can also cause infections, such as Haemophilus influenzae, Moraxella. Now, there is one therapeutic, which I suspect probably they would not get this detailed on the boards, but I think important to know about it, which is apicopan, which is a C5 receptor antagonist. This preserves MAC formation and doesn't inhibit MAC formation, so that meningeal risk falls away with that particular complement inhibitor. And then let's compare the terminal complement inhibitors to proximal complement inhibitors. And these are inhibitors that are impacting things like opsonization and phagocytosis of encapsulated bacteria. And so in addition to Neisseria, which is the biggest risk with the terminal cascade inhibition, these therapies also theoretically would increase one's risk to other encapsulated bacteria like Streptococcus, Haemophilus, et cetera. So just important to think about. And so in patients that are starting these therapeutics, it is absolutely vital that we get these patients vaccinated. There are two types of vaccines that they should receive. There's the quadrivalent vaccine and the serogroup B vaccine, which we've talked about in other lectures. We try to get these patients vaccinated at least 2 weeks before they start therapy. If they are unable, then they should be put on antibiotic prophylaxis, typically penicillin, but what agent you use for prophylaxis depends on patient's allergies and rates of resistance in the region. Many experts will continue, and I'll tell you at our center, we do continue antibiotic prophylaxis for the entire duration and through the half-life of cessation of complement inhibition therapy. But it's not a standard of care. It is provider dependent. So I think that's less likely to be something that they would test you about on the boards. You also need to recognize that patients that have pre-treatment risk for gonorrhea, and test them before you start treatment to avoid disseminated or severe gonorrheal infections. And then also recognize, I think a very testable concept on the board is that vaccination, antibiotic prophylaxis, you can do all those things right, but it's not going to prevent all cases of infection for a multitude of reasons. One is that the vaccine, as we know, doesn't cover all strains. A lot of these patients may have inadequate response to vaccines because they're already immune compromised, and there are issues of antimicrobial resistance. So all of these things, I think, are very testable about Neisseria on the boards. Important to recognize that there is also a risk for other encapsulated bacteria, but again, Neisseria being one of our biggest concerns. And education is paramount in these patients, talking to them about signs and symptoms of infection and when to seek immediate attention. Well, we're going to change gears and just briefly talk about another group of immune modulatory therapies. I'm only going to talk a little bit about this, but I think it's important to at least know these agents, what they're used for, and what we need to be thinking about as infectious disease providers. These are the, they're the sphingosine 1-phosphate or SIP1 receptor modulators. There's a multitude of agents. Their uses include inflammatory autoimmune disorders like multiple sclerosis, ulcerative colitis, and essentially they bind to the S1P receptor on the lymphocyte, and they inhibit the lymphocyte's ability to follow the gradient to egress from the lymph nodes, such that they essentially get the lymphocytes get sequestered in the lymph nodes. And that has an impact on one's infection risk, and most notably, the viral infection risk, especially latent viruses that do not reside in the lymph, that reside in the CNS, such as things that are residing in our dorsal root or trigeminal ganglion, like VZV or HSV. These are the kind of risks associated with these therapies, so much so that in terms of an infection prevention and patients being started on S1P receptor modulators, the recommendation is that they should get VZV antibody screening. If they're seronegative, they should be vaccinated. And if they're seropositive, they need to make sure that they have received their recombinant zoster vaccine. Okay, let's move to another question. All right, so this is a 35-year-old woman. She has relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis. She's been receiving natalizumab for 20 months. Which of the following are not considered relevant for risk estimation for progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy to guide decisions regarding the use of natalizumab therapy? Is it the JC virus antibody status, her history and prior immunosuppressive therapies, the duration of natalizumab therapy, the JC virus antibody index, or a JC virus plasma PCR? I'll give folks a moment to think about the answer to that. Incorrect answer is JC virus plasma PCR. And let's talk about why that is not the most predictive of risk for PML in this patient when deciding about the use of natalizumab. I think importantly, again, from this, you want to recognize natalizumab as an integrin inhibitor, and that it is a antibody that targets the alpha 4 subunit of integrin, and is very important in blocking T cell, B cell, and monocyte trafficking, adhesion, as well as migration across the blood-brain barrier. Also know that it has some effects on other receptors in the gut endothelium that can decrease the migration of memory T cells. It's most commonly utilized in autoimmune and inflammatory conditions like multiple sclerosis and Crohn's disease. And I want to very clearly differentiate it from other integrin inhibitors, such as vedolizumab, which is an alpha 4 B7 integrin inhibitor, also used for inflammatory bowel disease, but does not have that same impact on migration across the blood-brain barrier. And so the risk of infection, specifically with PML, which is what our question was really focusing on, is far lower. And again, on the board, the most likely thing to be questioned about is PML and JC virus mediated PML in patients receiving this specific integrin inhibitor. And so talking about the infection risks, again, that's 1, 2, and 3 that we need to be thinking about. These patients are also at risk for other CNS viral infections, such as HSV and VZV. They're at risk for these viruses in general, but also in particular, thinking about the CNS manifestations that they can cause. And there are also reports of acute retinal necrosis with this therapy. And in general, they can be associated with other infection and opportunistic infections. But that oftentimes, as we mentioned before, is kind of dependent on what other therapeutics and underlying diseases, et cetera, that they have. I really, again, want to focus on PML. This is a, you know, we will talk about this again when I lecture on infections in neutropenic patients and hematopoietic cell transplant patients, but this is a really, really key question that you need to know for the managing patients and also for being board ready. So this is a demyelinating CNS infection that's associated with JC virus. And the risks for that include, and this is really getting back to the question, being JC virus antibody positive, kind of the degree of, they do this index to assess the degree of positivity and the fluctuation across time, how long one has been on integrin therapy, and also prior use of immunosuppressive therapies. There is no role of JC virus PCR in the blood in sort of delineation of risk of PML in terms of any sort of a risk management and monitoring protocol. And so that's why that was the incorrect answer. Patients on this therapy do have to be enrolled in a risk management program, and they monitor them very frequently at 3 months and at 6 months after stopping, every 6 months thereafter, and then for up to 6 months after coming off of therapy. When we think about PML and how it presents, the goal is actually to detect it when the patients are still asymptomatic through very close monitoring. And including all the things that we mentioned, these patients oftentimes will get baseline and then some degree of serial MRIs, although I don't think you'd be specifically tested on anything about the frequency of those. But when they do present with symptoms, it can be really progressive, also can have kind of subacute deficits with cognitive impairment, ipsilateral weakness, visual changes, ataxic gait, aphasia. In terms of CNS imaging, there are some classic findings on CNS imaging. By no means do the figures to the right demonstrate all the classic findings, but characteristic of PML would be this asymmetric distribution, what you're seeing on CT. In the far left upper, you see these hypo-intense lesions. On T1 with contrast, you also see hypo-intense lesions. You do not see contrast enhancement. You do not see mass effect. And then on T2 and flare, you see these asymmetric characteristic hyper-intense lesions. And these findings sometimes are used to differentiate it from other mimics like things like press. There's also sparing typically of the gray matter. Diagnostics typically involve a lumbar puncture, looking in the CSF for PCR. Again, the PCR specifically looking for JC virus PCR, as well as brain biopsy. Unfortunately, there is no standard effective proven treatment for this, and this is a devastating diagnosis. Immune restoration is key, and we immediately would cease therapy, and oftentimes they consider PLEX to remove the drug. And I think it's important to also recognize that in a patient that comes off therapy and then clearly is getting worse, you have to think about post-succession iris with PML, that can occur. And that potentially would be a board testable question as well. So we're going to leave the integrin inhibitors and let's move to another class of therapeutics. So in this question stem, we have a 54-year-old man. He's got metastatic non-small cell lung cancer who's been on 3 months of combination therapy with nivolumab and ipilimumab. He had presented with several weeks of progressing dyspnea and cough. A CT scan at that time, shown in the bottom left figure, demonstrated diffuse ground glass opacities. At that time, he was ultimately diagnosed with a grade 2 immune checkpoint inhibitor-related pneumonitis, and he was initiated on high-dose steroids, 1 mg/kg/day, and pretty rapidly improved, and plans were made for a very slow steroid taper. He now comes back to see you in clinic 8 weeks later. He's still on a steroid taper. He's on 30 milligrams a day, and he has recurrence of the cough, dyspnea. He's now having fevers, and he's markedly fatigued. His laboratory studies show that his white count's 12,000 and he's lymphopenic with an ALC of 300. His hepatic and renal indices are normal. And we repeat a CT scan and his images now are shown to the bottom right. And so the question, in considering this really complicated case, is which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Do you resume oral prednisone and increase it to 2 mg/kg/day? Do you add a TNF-alpha therapy? Do you add infliximab? Do you add mycophenolate mofetil, 1 gram twice a day? Do you add Bactrim at a dose of a double strength 3 times weekly? Or do you obtain further diagnostics, including a bronchoscopy and a bronchoalveolar lavage, looking for bacterial, fungal, and AFB cultures, as well as for pneumocystis? So I'll give you a moment to think about that. I'm going to scan back to the prior so you can kind of look at a CT scan 10 weeks ago, the CT scan today. Clearly, these areas of ground glass opacity are now showing evidence of dense consolidation, and there's worsening ground glass, and the patient clinically is worse. And at this point, you cannot assume that this is a checkpoint inhibitor toxicity, and I think further diagnostics are in order, so you would want to perform a bronchoscopy with bronchoalveolar lavage for bacterial, fungal, and AFB cultures, as well as pneumocystis PCR. You might ask, well, why not empirically start him on treatment? PCP would probably run to the top of your differential. But if you note the dosing of the sulfamethoxazole trimethoprim there is double strength 3 times a week, which is a prophylactic dose. And that's why that's not a correct answer. All right. So let's talk about immune checkpoint inhibitors. There are a multitude of agents. They have many targets, PD-1, PD-L1, CTLA-4, and LAG-3, and I've kind of listed those there. Again, that level of detail I don't expect would be required for the boards, but to recognize these drugs and what they're being used for, in our particular case, a very common indication for non-small cell lung cancer, other certain solid tumors. The mechanism and the immune deficit that we see related to this is that these tumors evade the immune surveillance. By blocking that, you essentially activate the immune system. So it's unlike other therapeutics where we're talking about immune suppression, these therapeutics causing immune suppression. In this situation, they're actually causing immune activation. And so much of what we're dealing with when we're thinking about these therapies at times is not actually infection, but it's these immune-related adverse effects, and these can often mimic infection. And so trying to delineate what is an infection versus an immune-related adverse effect. And those can affect any organ system. You can have pneumonitis in the lungs, colitis in the GI tract. You can have rash and other manifestations of the skin. It can affect the endocrine system, the kidneys, the CNS, you name it. And the other tricky piece to this, and is really reflected in this question, is not only can they cause toxicity, these immune-related toxicities, but when the toxicities are severe enough, they require further immune suppressive therapy to treat it. It's typically steroids, as was in this case, but if it's refractory, other therapeutics such as TNF-alpha inhibitors and mycophenolate can be added. And that further increases one's risk of infections. And so I think highly testable on the boards are these infectious mimics, these immune-related adverse events, as well as the infectious complications that come not only from applying immune suppressive therapy to treat the immune-related adverse effects, but also just from the generalized dysregulated immunity we see when these patients have this immune activation. And that question, while complex, I think really brought all of those factors to light. I put this table in here really, I think, more for you guys to have to go back to have something to refer to when thinking about different presentations that patients may come to clinic or be admitted with when on immune checkpoint inhibitors that could be immune-related adverse effects, but also have infectious considerations and kind of thinking through those. I think those sorts of scenarios are very testable for the board. This is a beautiful table that I adapted from a really nice article from CID from Dr. Fishman and colleagues that, if you have a special interest in this, it's worth a read, but it really does highlight some of these kind of infectious mimics and potential opportunistic pathogens. I think a couple other additional testable concepts I put on here that, again, these opportunistic infections you see could be due to the treatment for the immune-related adverse effects, but also because of these dysregulated immunity pathways. Think about even cases where they might present a patient that had a really profound inflammatory TB presentation where basically latent TB developed in a patient receiving these therapeutics. Viral reactivation is another consideration. And then also, although rare, checkpoint inhibitors can cause cytokine release syndrome. Although that's a much more common, CRS is a much more common testable association with things like chimeric antigen receptor therapy and bispecific therapies, which we will touch on in a separate lecture at the live course. And then I will close with one additional group of therapeutics, and I think it's a really important one. I have some cases that are burned in my brain that I have seen with patients with infections complications on Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And this is a particular case of mine, actually, with a 62-year-old gentleman with underlying CLL. He was on single agent ibrutinib therapy, and he'd been on that therapy for 4 months. He came in with fevers, confusion, dysarthria, and significant word-finding difficulties. And I'm showing you here his MRI brain, where you see, really substantial lesions with surrounding perilesional edema. And then he's got this sort of a spiculated nodular appearing lesion in his right lung on chest CT imaging. He ultimately underwent this larger lesion brain biopsy. And here is the histopathology from the brain biopsy on GMS staining. And you have to kind of look really close and believe me when I'm saying this, but what you're seeing here is septated, hyphae with acute angle branching, consistent with invasive aspergillosis. And I think, again, really important that we're thinking about these therapeutics. The most commonly tested and used, the kind of the oldest of the group, is ibrutinib, although acalabrutinib and some of these other therapeutics are now utilized as well. We most commonly apply them in underlying hematologic conditions like CLL and lymphoma. But again, the use of these agents is expanding. And, the mechanism by which they create this immune defect is multifold, but it is a key enzyme in B cell receptor signaling. And so blocking it, you block the downstream activation of B cell receptor pathway, cell growth, you inhibit macrophage function. and other, and thereby in that way impact the innate immunity against fungal infections. And so risks of infections, I think I've tried to make the point in this case. I mean, we can see bacterial infections, we can see viral infections, but I think a very testable infection you could see here are opportunistic infections, inclusive of disseminated disease with CNS involvement, whether that be aspergillus, like the case I just presented, or cryptococcosis or pneumocystis. And there is some thought that in addition to affecting the macrophage function, there are microglial cells, which are essentially the macrophages in the brain, and that they can inhibit the function of those. And that may in part be a reason that these patients are more susceptible to CNS type infections, although there are a multitude of theoretical risks as to why we might see that. But I think important to recognize that that risk does exist. And while we don't specifically recommend that these patients be put on fungal prophylaxis when on these therapeutics, it's important to recognize the risk. And then also you have to think about what other agents they're on, because they may be on other concomitant therapies like high-dose steroids that do warrant consideration and prophylaxis. And so we'll close with this final slide. And I know this is a very busy slide, but the intent of the slide is for you guys to have this as a review. After you listen to the lecture and go back through and think about these therapies, I tried to summarize the different classes of immune modulatory therapies, some specific examples, so the most commonly applied or the oldest therapies that I think would be most likely to be tested on the boards, as well as the essential board buzz, if you will, what those specific infection risks or certain infection mimics or other important things that I think are very testable on the board as it relates to these specific agents. And then finally, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me. I've left my email here. I'm always happy to take questions, discuss cases, and talk through what, you know, I think are relevant issues for the boards. I will also be there at the live session, and we'll be talking about infections in neutropenic cancer patients, as well as infections in hematopoietic cell transplant recipients. So I hope to see you all there, and we can certainly talk about your questions at that time as well. Thanks again for your time, and best of luck to you all on the boards.